Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by the Society for Human Resource Management, meeting the challenges of a changing world. Online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 million in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When you hear a structural warning like this one, the words severe weakness, what do you think of right away? Here's another hint. It came today from the biggest supplier of financing for mortgages in the country. So you're getting the right picture if the image of a shaky house of cards comes to mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, global provider of fuels, power, and energy services. Committed to sound, efficient, sustainable energy solutions. Constellation.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. We appreciate you joining us on this Tuesday, the 6th day of May. So who says the worst is over? Certainly not the underwriter of the biggest share of mortgages in America. Fannie Mae posted dismal earnings for the first quarter of the year, a loss of more than $2 billion. That has investors bracing for more big losses when Fannie Mae's federally sponsored cousin, Freddie Mac, reports its results later in the week. Both of the big firms have been key in keeping the mortgage market alive during the ongoing credit squeeze, all of which is raising all kinds of concerns about what will happen if things get even worse. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
First of all, let's review exactly what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac do. When you take out a mortgage, chances are the bank or savings and loan or mortgage company turns around and sells that mortgage to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. They, in turn,
will securitize that mortgage by selling portfolios of the mortgage to investors.
Chris Mayer studies real estate at Columbia's business school. Fannie and Freddie promise to pay those investors if anybody defaults on the mortgage. What makes them different is that the government oversees their operations and lets Fannie and Freddie get away with having smaller reserves than other institutions. Perhaps more important, though, is the understanding that if either got into trouble, the feds would bail them out.
As a result of what is referred to as an implicit guarantee, people are willing to lend to them at very cheap rates.
But that implicit guarantee is what's making people nervous about Fannie Mae's losses. Nobody's expecting Fannie Mae's imminent demise. Still, if it ends up needing a bailout, it would cost taxpayers a lot of money and potentially have really dire consequences for the housing market. Chris Mayer.
For the moment, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the major lenders left in this game. And if they were to have problems that forced them to cut back on mortgage lending, there would almost literally be no one left to go to get a mortgage.
But some say those kinds of predictions mean we're getting ahead of ourselves. John Quigley is an economist at the University of California, Berkeley.
The specific Fannie Mae loss is small potatoes in the general course of things in the economy, but it indicates the enormous instability in the housing market.
So is today's news no big deal?
It's more worrisome because there's potentially more federal resources on the hook, but it is not a calamity in and of itself.
Fannie Mae, meanwhile, says it's going to start raising more capital, $6 billion, it says, by selling more shares. It's also warning that it expects losses from mortgage defaults to be even worse next year. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Don't bother stopping me if you've heard this one before. Oil prices hit yet a new record today. A barrel of crude topped $122 on the New York Mercantile Exchange, and Goldman Sachs is warning prices could hit $200 a barrel in the next few years. So you've got to wonder what automaker Chrysler is thinking. The company announced a new incentive this week. Through early June, customers who buy or lease a new Chrysler can lock in lower gas prices. Get this, for 3 years. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Remember when paying $3 a gallon seemed crazy? Now it's a marketing pitch. The deal works like this. Anyone who buys a new Chrysler car or truck, except for a few models, will get a gas card. Swipe that card at a participating gas station and you pay $2.99 a gallon. Chrysler pays the rest. With gas prices expected to reach $4 a gallon this summer, it may seem like a risky bet. But Chrysler says it's hedged against higher prices. And after a certain number of gallons, depending on the model, you're cut off. Industry consultant Joe Philippi says the promotion is likely to cost less than the usual cash-back incentives.
I think this is their idea of how to sort of break through the clutter to get the customer's attention.
Higher gas prices have been weighing on consumers' minds and automakers' sales. Chrysler's truck sales fell 25% last month. Eric Merkel tracks the industry for research firm IRN. He says Chrysler's gas gimmick may get customers back in some of those larger vehicles for now.
Right now, Chrysler's got to play the cards they have. But long term, there's no question that Chrysler is far too heavily wedded on trucks.
Chrysler is teaming up with Nissan to offer smaller cars in a few years. It's not the first automaker to lure customers with cheap gas. Suzuki is offering free fuel this summer. GM tried its own promotion a few years ago with limited success. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
The military government of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, says the death toll from the powerful cyclone that hit that country this week has risen above 20,000. All the more incredible, 40,000 people are still missing. UN relief agencies estimate that hundreds of thousands of survivors urgently need food and shelter. And that's just the short-term challenge. As Marketplace's Steve Henn reports, the storm will keep sending ripples through rice markets across the world for some time to come.
The cyclone slammed into the heart of Myanmar's rice-growing region, and that won't help prices, say traders. Poor harvests and rising demand have pushed prices through the roof, and Myanmar was expected to sell 500,000 tons of rice abroad this year. Now those sales are in doubt. The country isn't a major rice supplier, but it's growing in importance, and this morning the price of rice soared half a world away. I reached John Casey on his cell phone, trading in the rice pit at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
It's a sizable amount, and in a situation like this, it could very well make a difference. Look for new highs, new high prices.
Higher food prices are straining the budgets of international aid organizations now rushing relief into Myanmar. Batima Lauscher is with the UN World Food Program.
We have made an urgent appeal to the world to give us extra funding because our food prices have gone up between June and February. They've gone up by like 55%.
And that was just the beginning.
In early March, we paid like $460 per metric ton of rice in Bangkok. And just last week or so, it was $1,200. And that, of course, was all before any of this devastation.
The World Food Program's distributing more than 800 tons of food to cyclone survivors. But what Lauscher calls the silent tsunami of rising food prices could impact hundreds of millions more across the globe. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Those ever-resourceful folks on Wall Street climbed atop those collapsing housing numbers we told you about earlier and built themselves a higher vantage point. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Russia goes through a momentous changing of the guard in a matter of hours. President Vladimir Putin is handing over the reins to his successor, Dmitry Medvedev, a 42-year-old corporate lawyer who's been head of the state-controlled energy giant Gazprom. Putin isn't straying too far. He'll continue serving as prime minister and still has strong support among the Russian people, built on a booming economy. Joining us is Martha Brill Alcott. She's with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you.
What is Putin's legacy going to be in terms of Russia's economy now? And for that matter, is it too early to talk about Putin's legacy since he's still going to be such a force there?
I think it really is too early to talk about Putin's legacy. Not only is it clear that he's still going to be a force after tomorrow, but we really won't know the legacy until the price of oil drops and we get to see what the base of the economy is in the long run.
The spike in oil prices is a huge boon to Russia's economy. How big a part does oil play in state revenues?
Oil revenues really provide the basis of the state's ability to continue to provide a welfare net for the population. It's really been the basis of Putin's popularity. The tax structure that the Russian government put in before they had any idea that the oil prices would go so high has really worked to the benefit of the central government there because it really taxes all oil income over about $35 a barrel.
The incoming president, Medvedev, has a reputation of being more liberal than Putin. What, if any, economic policy changes might we expect?
One of the things that people have been hoping is that there'll be a liberalization of taxes that relate to oil and gas sales. That would be very important because even though Russia is making the bulk of its tax revenues from the fossil fuel sector, there's been very little reinvestment into greenfield production and expanding existing production in Russia's fields. This is very important for Russia if Russia is going to be able to continue to be a major supplier of gas for Europe and the second largest oil producer in the world.
Well, speaking of that kind of investment, a lot of countries like China and Europe have been investing in Russia's resources from oil to apple juice. The U.S. hasn't. What are we afraid of, and are we missing out on anything?
U.S. firms in the oil and gas sector have tried to get in to Russia, but have either not been as favored by the Kremlin or have not been willing to take some of the risks that European firms and Chinese firms have been willing to take.
Is this an arena that the U.S. needs to be more active in?
I think as the Russian economy improves, it's impossible for the U.S. as a global economic power to remain distant from Russia. But I don't think that there's going to be any sort of enormous break that makes it seem like U.S. firms have missed a great opportunity. It's going to be sector by sector as companies respond to overtures from potential Russian partners.
So overall, what is your take on things? When we see the new president come in, will there be major noticeable changes or will it be subtle?
I think it's going to be subtle. I think that there may be some rapid symbolic changes, but most of the quote-unquote changes that Medvedev will introduce will be forms of legislation that have been debated in the last part of Putin's administration and that people expected to come with his successor. So it's hard for me to see that Medvedev is going to be a great innovator. There'll be a lot of follow-through, and I think that he'll put on a cheery face for the beginning of his term, at least, trying to increase Western investor confidence in his country.
Martha Brill Olcott is a senior associate with the Russian and Eurasian program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The idea of catching criminals on camera is more popular than ever. The Brits have spent billions to keep a remote eye on citizens, but today a senior detective is making headlines there claiming surveillance cameras have barely made a dent in crime. In France, you might say they've actually caused it. Since speed cameras were introduced there in 2003, vandals have smashed them, blinded them with paint, or taken aim with rifles. Lately, a group calling itself the Armed Revolutionary Nationalist Faction, or FNAR, has turned to blowing them up. John Lawrenson reports from Paris.
Cars slowing to 30 miles an hour as they enter the little village of Perrois-les-Gombrés, north of Paris. A speed camera surveys each one with a glassy eye, ready to photograph offenders in a flash of white light. This camera's brand new. Its predecessor was blown up last month, one of a string of 10 similar attacks. In a cafe nearby, there's a good deal of support for the attackers. And people are not surprised a replacement camera was installed so quickly.
It's the biggest earning speed camera in the area. Over 30,000 people have been fined because of it. It's good this group destroyed it. If they could do it again, that would be even better.
I have to do a lot of driving for my job, and I pay a lot in road tolls to use the motorways, and still I'm not free to drive. Speed cameras? We should burn the lot of them.
In a letter published in a recent edition of Paris Match magazine, the FNAR reiterates its demands: removal of all speed cameras, lower taxes, and a $6 million payoff. The group also wants illegal immigrants to be deported and a price cap on basic consumer goods. But the FNAR are not the only ones with a motive to blow up the cameras. Jean-Baptiste Iosca is a lawyer who specializes in motoring offenses.
Actuellement, vous avez entre 90 000 et 200 000
Between 90 and 200,000 people lose their driver's license each year in France, with huge social consequences, because 40% of people who lose their driver's license lose their job. The people suffering most from this are not the people driving badly, but the people who drive a lot.
Like the cafe customers, Mr. Yoska believes money is behind the cameras. Speed cameras cost $150,000 each, but generate, on average, twice that in revenue in a year. According to the French government, speed cameras brought in $700 million in 2007. They also saved lives. Speed cameras are at the heart of an effective government campaign to improve road safety.
Sur la route, il n'y a pas de petite infraction. Respectons les règles.
A campaign backed by the League Against Road Violence, which represents the families of car crash victims. Its president, Chantal Perrichon, says the FNAR attacks are disgraceful.
On ne peut absolument pas excuser des gens qui s'attaquent à un système qui a sauvé des milliers de vies.
There's no excuse for attacking a system that has saved thousands of lives in France. Automatic speed controls and fines are the main reasons we've been able to bring down road deaths by 42% since 2002.
Mrs. Perrichon is delighted the government plans to install another 2,500 speed cameras over the next 5 years. I drive to another cafe down the road from the latest FNAR attack. There's another speed camera just outside. The owner tells me three youths destroyed it on the very day it was installed.
They smashed the lens, poured gasoline inside, and set it on fire. My opinion is that speed cameras can be useful, but not always, when they're put in places where there's no particular accident danger. Then they're just big piggy banks for the government.
He speaks with a slur, due, he says, to a motorcycle accident. He broke his jaw, spent a month in a coma, after being hit by a speeding car. If even victims of excessive speed can be cynical about speed cameras, Mrs. Perrichon and the French government really have a lot more convincing to do. In Perrois-les-Gombrés, I'm John Lawrenson for Marketplace.
Coming up, smooth sailing for the houseboat market.
It doesn't go up and down, it just goes up. It just constantly goes up.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors shrugged off housing worries and record oil prices to put together a modest rally today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average clicked up 0.4%, or 51 points, to end the day at 13,020. The NASDAQ tacked on 0.75%, or 19 points, to finish at 2483. The S&P 500 added 0.75%, or 10 points, to close at 1417. Nothing like a $2.2 billion quarterly loss to bolster your stock price. At least that was the case for Fannie Mae. Its shares picked up 9% after a rough morning. The prospect of increased government regulation in the home loan sector appeased investors. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.92. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at Putnam.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for March. A Senate committee examines the current financial state of the airline industry and the potential impact of the Delta Northwest merger. And the House Judiciary Committee's Antitrust Task Force holds the first in a series of hearings on rising gas prices. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, sitting in for Kai Ryssdal. If you followed the rather clumsy ballet between Yahoo and Microsoft in the past few weeks, you could probably see this one coming. Some angry Yahoo investors have filed suit against CEO Jerry Yang and the Yahoo board. Shareholders are claiming the board's failure to control Yang has cost them billions of dollars in value. The wedding might be off, but commentator and venture capitalist Paul Kodrosky says both Yang and Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer could still use some counseling.
After weeks of not talking in the endless $44 billion takeover struggle between Microsoft and Yahoo, Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer and Yahoo CEO Jerry Yang finally got together last week in romantic Seattle, and then they noisily broke off the courtship in a barrage of press releases. The two men are clearly hurt and confused at the breakup. Consider, Yahoo's Yang apparently told Microsoft's Ballmer on Saturday that he was willing to take $37 a share for Yahoo. But Microsoft's Ballmer is equally confused. He says he made a $33 a share offer for Yahoo, which is $2 more than he had said previously. But Yahoo says that Microsoft's Ballmer didn't actually make the $33 offer in the meeting. Sure, it may have been said to Yahoo's lawyers, but not to Yang directly. So Jerry Yang is hurt. And it's gotten worse since, with Jerry sending Steve love notes through the media. Meanwhile, shareholders, think of them as parents, have spanked Jerry for passing on Microsoft's massive offer. So Jerry is giving plaintive interviews, saying that he is still open to talking, that he was confused about Microsoft's $33 a share offer, and that he still has feelings for Microsoft. You see, it's all he said, he said. The two people who should be talking directly to one another are talking right past one another. Sure, Jerry Yang and Steve Ballmer are billionaire CEOs and generally unsympathetic, but the two of them need our help. Even if their dysfunctional confusion at the end of this tech company courtship reminds me of texting teenagers, please talk to me, no, please talk to me, we need to be there for them, at least for a hug. After that, we can fire them, of course. I mean, who turns down a $44 billion takeover offer? Who messes up a deal this big? Are they nuts?
Paul Kodrosky is editor of the blog Infectious Greed and a senior fellow at the Kauffman Foundation. The Kauffman Foundation underwrites Marketplace's entrepreneurship desk. Communicate with us. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Here's yet another casualty from the softening credit market. Word that General Electric's consumer finance division will no longer provide loans to buyers of recreational vehicles and most watercraft. GE Money has notified manufacturers it'll stop offering boat and RV loans as of August 1st. It's apparently not making enough of a return on those loans. There are some less troubled waters. The market for houseboats seems to be, shall we say, floating right along. And it just so happens that one of the most famous houseboats in the world is up for sale. From KPLU in Seattle, Hannah Jaffe Waltz takes us on a tour.
At the end of a long, skinny wooden dock, under whirling seaplanes and a cloudless sky, there sits a realtor who has been waiting a decade and a half to say these words.
We're aboard Sleepless in Seattle, we call it, the real thing. This was in the movie 15 years ago.
And now it is Rick Miner's to sell. The Sleepless in Seattle houseboat, the very one from the 1990s Tom Hanks romantic comedy. It is the holy grail of floating real estate. Miner specializes in houseboats. He shows me around the 2,000 square feet, in and out of four bedrooms, and into the living room.
Here you can see in the living room, there's just open windows and the sailboat over on one side, and there's open water everywhere. Then you step out onto the deck, and you just have this grand view. You can't get any further out on the lake without swimming or being in a boat.
Okay, in case you missed the Sleepless thing, a quick summary. Tom Hanks is a widower in a houseboat. This houseboat. He talks loneliness with the radio show host. Meg Ryan hears it, and then the two fall in love on the top of the Empire State Building. And then houseboats become a national romantic fantasy.
It really helped. Yeah. It really did.
Conrad Waters is CEO of Federal Mortgage in Seattle. He's been financing houseboats for 25 years. It's his love. But he does land, too. And Waters says Seattle real estate has remained much stronger than the rest of the country, but it has been slowing down recently, except for houseboats. Houseboats are their own breed. Doesn't matter what happens in the rest of the country. They exist on a different plane, on floating logs, actually. Houseboats may bob with the cool water, but not with the land market.
No, it doesn't go up and down. It just goes up. It just constantly goes up.
That's mostly because they're popular. Thank you, Tom Hanks. And there aren't a lot of them. Add a little star value to that, and
the house is listed for $2.5 million.
But realtor Rick Miner prefers not to focus on the price, but the product. With hand on shoulder, he leads me back out to the deck.
It's quiet out here, isn't it? It's really quiet. And where else would you want to be in Seattle? It's out here on Sleepless in Seattle.
Did Tom Hanks touch this?
Did he touch this? Yes, they shot the entire... Let's go back into the living room here.
This tour could go on forever. All the things Tom Hanks did or might have touched. And the view speaks for itself. It's all what makes this one of the most expensive houseboats in America. Rick Miner hasn't gotten any offers yet, but he says the independent houseboat market always pulls through. In Seattle, I'm Hannah Jaffe Walt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, you'll find the seediest bunch of make-believe characters doing all kinds of nasty things to each other in the latest version of the violent video game Grand Theft Auto. It's only been out a week, and already things are getting nasty in the real world. Take-Two Interactive Software is accusing the Chicago Transit Authority of violating its freedom of speech. The game maker is suing because ads that were supposed to appear on the sides of buses and transit displays through next month disappeared after this critical story from the local Fox TV affiliate.
An especially violent weekend in Chicago. Over 24 people shot.
And it don't make no sense.
And what did we spot on CTA buses and platforms? Advertisements for the unapologetically violent video game, Grand Theft Auto.
Marketers were forced to label an earlier sexually graphic version of the game with the rating AO for adults only. The lawsuit suggests the Transit Authority might be trying to back out of the ad deal because this latest version carries the M rating for mature. I guess there's no AI rating for adults immature. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 51 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq added 19 points, 0.75%. The S&P 500 gained 10 points, also 0.75%. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on the program, the start of our series, Food Fight, a look at the global food crisis.
I kind of use the example that if everybody ate like an American as I go around the world, that seems to be their goal. We need about another 2.3 globes.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.